Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is October 11th. Last class period, you had a test, and fortunately, I was able to get those graded on Thursday, so I put your grades in Blackboard. Most people have their grades in Blackboard, but there are still some people that put their Scantron in the wrong pile or various reasons. I couldn't figure out where your grades belong. So you'll have to see me. I'm in class all day tomorrow, so Thursday will be a good time for you to get that straightened out. All right, so hopefully your grades are there and observable, and starting again on Thursday, you can view your tests if you see me during office hours or catch me in the hall before or after your lab or class, and you can check it out. And I highly recommend that you all check out your grades, okay? All right, so we're going to start a new chapter for the next test, and that's Chapter 9, Autonomic Nervous System. If you need to go back and review your anatomy, then I would highly recommend doing that, because right now you should know that there are two main divisions of the autonomic nervous system, and there's a special interaction between them. So what are the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system? You got sympathetic and parasympathetic, and what's the relationship between them? They're antagonistic to each other, right? And that's a really nice thing, because what does antagonism provide for? Precise control. And one other thing? Balance in your body. All right, so let me get this in the right mode. How do I get it in the right mode? Click. Aha. Okay, so I think a good place to start is to realize what the effector organs are. Can you remember a response loop? Okay, and you don't see the slide. Here we go. Oh, I know what to do. No, I don't know what to do. I'll do that. And it should pop up over here. And should I turn the lights off? Can you see that? No, you're good for right now? Okay. If that doesn't work, let me know. All right, so autonomic nervous system, introduction. All right, it manages our physiology by regulating its effector organs. And in your mind, you should have three classes of effector organs. All right, so don't forget, what does an effector organ do? It produces a response of some kind. So what are the effector organs of the autonomic nervous system, as opposed to the somatic nervous system? We're going to talk about both of those before we move to the next slide. Autonomic nervous system. The three classes of effector organs are cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands, right? So when we say autonomic nervous system, it means that you do not have voluntary control over these things. These things are taken care of automatically for you. But now, what is the one thing that you do have conscious control over in your body? Skeletal muscle, and that's the effector organ for your somatic nervous system, right? So somatic versus autonomic. Okay. Smooth muscle maintains resting tone in the absence of nerve stimulation. So smooth muscle can kind of take care of itself, like the heart. And when nervous system innervation to a smooth muscle is abrogated, right, if it becomes cut, then the smooth muscle becomes more active. So the autonomic nervous system actually has a way to what? Inhibit smooth muscle and controlling its activity. Many types of smooth muscle are spontaneously active, and that should remind you of another kind of muscle. And that's not going to be skeletal muscle, but there's another kind of muscle that is spontaneously active, and it contracts rhythmically even without autonomic nervous system innervation. And what is that other muscle? It's cardiac muscle as well. So smooth muscle and cardiac muscle has some similarities. And autonomic nervous system innervation just increases or decreases this inherent rate of rhythmicity within these different kinds of muscle. All right, so let's take a look at some neurons. This is kind of a review, so maybe I'm going to go over this really fast. All right, on the top of the slide, you know what I'm going to have to do? I have no idea how to get back. Back arrow? Yeah, back arrow. Now, how do I get an arrow? Ah, there it is. How do I get arrow options? Nope. Ah, there's arrow options, pointer options. Sorry, the mouse went dead. So I'm using a different kind of device. So if I slide over without going up or down, nice. What can I do? Oh, then I gotta slide over again. Oh, I almost went outside the box. Okay, now the arrow won't go away. Previous slide. All right, so here we have, let's look at the graphics on the right-hand side. Oops, wrong button again, rats. All right, well, let's look at the graphics are still there. Let me not go back. Okay, so this top graphic, all right, I see an effector organ right here. And what kind of organ does that look like? Looks like skeletal muscle, right? And then on the bottom slide, I see an effector organ down over here. And there are some muscles in this tube. And this is, for instance, could be digestive tract or urinary tract or even reproductive tract. So what kind of muscle is in this tube down here? It's going to be smooth muscle, right? All right, so we said that the somatic motor system controls skeletal muscle under your voluntary control. And here I see a neuron. Here's a cell body in the spinal cord, and this one neuron goes all the way to the effector neuron without synapsing. So it just requires one somatic motor neuron to go from CNS all the way out to the periphery to this effector organ. And we're going to contrast that pathway with the outflow pathway with an autonomic nervous system. Here we see a cell body in the central nervous system, and this is spinal cord. A good example of this would be the sympathetic nervous system, because sympathetic outflow is, can anybody remember what sympathetic outflow is? It is thoracolumbar, right? And parasympathetic is cranial sacral. So since we're in the spinal cord, that is thoracolumbar. So this is sympathetic outflow. Here is the first neuron, right? Here's the cell body in the lateral horn of the gray matter of the spinal cord. Goes out the what root is this going to be? It's going to be the ventral root. That's an outflow pathway. Remember, these roots are always going to be different. Here is the dorsal root, and then here is the ventral root. Remember, the dorsal root is 100% what? Sensory. What's another name for sensory? Afferent, right? And the ventral root is 100% motor, which means signals are leaving the central nervous system, going out to the periphery. All right, so here is one neuron, but notice that it leaves and it goes into the sympathetic chain ganglia and it ends. And so here is a synapse. And here's a little bulge. What do we call a bulge of these nerve cell bodies? I got the point of the arrow on the nerve cell body. Okay, yeah, so here's a ganglion, right? A group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system is a ganglion. These right here are on either side of the spinal cord. You could think of these as like little accessory spinal cords for sympathetic outflow. And so they're called the sympathetic chain ganglia because they're interrelated. The ganglia that are superior are connected to the ganglia down below it under some circumstances. All right, so this first nerve fiber, which kind of looks a little bluish to me, is that blue, this one right here? Yeah, like a light blue. All right, that's the preganglionic neuron. And then after the synapse, that's the postganglionic neuron. You can see in this particular example, leaving the sympathetic chain, and it goes all the way to the effector organ. All right, so that's the inherent difference. One motor neuron for somatic outflow, but two motor neurons for autonomic outflow, and it really doesn't matter whether it's sympathetic outflow or parasympathetic outflow. For autonomic motor outflow, it is always going to require two. And this synapse between the preganglionic and postganglionic fiber is a nice chemical synapse. So what has to be used across the synaptic cleft right here? A neurotransmitter, that's right. Okay, and so we're going to have to learn something about the different neurotransmitters that are used for the preganglionic fiber and the postganglionic fiber. It might be the same or it might be different depending on the outflow pathway. All right, let's see what I have on this slide right here. Odd divisions of the autonomic nervous system, right? There are two divisions. Usually they are antagonistic to each other. The sympathetic nervous system is characterized by the fight and flight response. And the parasympathetic is responsible for the rest and digest or rest and repose response. So if you ever want to think, maybe you haven't memorized a particular action of the sympathetic nervous system, just use these two different models of thinking to guide which way the one part of the autonomic nervous system is going to affect a gland. Like for instance, when you're in a stressful situation, should your heart rate be elevated or should it be depressed? It should be elevated, okay? Because it's pumping blood to muscles, because maybe if it's a stressful situation you need to run away, those muscles need a lot of oxygen and glucose in order to function, okay? So what helps maintain blood pressure is an increase in heart rate, but also the contractility of your heart is going to increase as well. That's part of the flight and flight response. Now what about your vision? Should your pupils be really small? Should your iris be contracted or should your iris be really large? Should the iris be dilated? They take in a lot of light so that you can see what's going on. All right, so dilation is another effect of the sympathetic nervous system. Which then kind of means that, what about the parasympathetic nervous system? Okay, for these two effects that we just mentioned, which is going to be rest and digest. What about your heart rate with parasympathetic nervous system? It's going to be decreased. Parasympathetic nervous system doesn't affect the contractility of the heart, but it sure does slow the heart rate down. And as far as pupil dilation, it's going to have the opposite effect. So parasympathetic is going to what? Cause dilation or constriction of the pupils? Constriction. Okay, and here is something interesting. Is in terms of the digestive tract, right, this is important because you can't always say the sympathetic nervous system is going to be excitatory and parasympathetic is going to be inhibitory. You just know it's going to be opposite. Right? Here's a good example where the parasympathetic nervous system is excitatory on your digestive system, because when you're in a stressful situation, you don't need to be digesting food. You need all that blood supply away from your digestive organs going to your brain, your heart, and muscles to deal with that situation. And you can take care of digesting your food at a later time, for instance, if you're lucky enough to live through that stressful situation, right? So parasympathetic increases digestion. Sympathetic innervation on the digestive system is what? Excitatory or inhibitory? It's going to be inhibitory. It's going to have the opposite effect. So that's a really good way to just think of sympathetic versus parasympathetic nervous system, right, in terms of fight and flight versus rest and repose nervous system. Okay, sympathetic is also what we call thoracolumbar. Sorry, I can't just use the pointer fast enough to make it really effective in here. All right, but it's thoracolumbar. That's the only way sympathetic innervation leaves the central nervous system. And these nerves leave, and since this is not an anatomy book, I don't think it always gets it exactly right. All right, so let's go over that. Oh, maybe the next slide has a zoomed in one. Nope, not really. Okay, so here are the two pathways that enter or leave the spinal cord. Right, the dorsal root is in the back, the ventral root is in the front, and the ventral root is motor. How are you going to remember which root is which? And remember, it's 100%. What's a really easy, actually it's kind of an idiotic trick, but I use it all the time to remember, if I have to just stop and think a second. How do you know the ventral root is motor? Okay, you can think of the architecture of the brain. Okay, because in the front, that's the motor, sensory is posterior or dorsal, but sensory is dorsal. But an easy way to realize, to just remember this, is that there's a T in motor, right, and there's a T in ventral. there's an S in sensory and there's an S in dorsal. So that's a, I don't know if you, your brains are even so simple as mine to remember it. But that's how I could remember that in 20 years from now if I had to pass a board exam. So you might find that helpful. So the outflow is via this ventral root, okay, and then it joins the spinal nerve. Remember that a spinal nerve is mixed. It has both afferent and efferent fibers going through the spinal nerve, and then it gets over to this region right here. Sympathetic nerves break away from the spinal nerve, and it goes into this rami communicantes, and it's actually the second one over here, and it enters the sympathetic chain, and if I remember correctly, this is the gray ramus communicantes, because this is a non-myelinated fiber, and maybe I have it backwards. It's not coming back to me. Which one is gray and which one is white? Because one of these, the preganglionic is, who remembers that? Which one is non-myelinated? Is it the preganglionic or postganglionic? All right, so the preganglionic is myelinated. So this is the white ramus communicantes right here where the cursor is. And then if it synapses in the ganglion, the postganglionic fiber is non-myelinated, so it doesn't look white, it looks gray. So here, this is the gray rami communicantes. And then, for instance, that sympathetic nerve can then rejoin the spinal nerve and course wherever that spinal nerve is going to the effector organ. Or it can pass through the sympathetic chain, okay, through a splanchnic nerve and go to an effector organ. Or it can even synapse or arise a couple of divisions or descend a couple divisions before it synapses in a ganglion before it leaves the sympathetic chain to join its effector organ someplace. So there are various outflow pathways. So these, the sympathetic chain, sometimes are called the paravertebral because they're on what? Either side of the spinal cord. If a preganglionic neuron doesn't synapse in the sympathetic chain, it passes through a splanchnic nerve, and it goes to a ganglia someplace in front of the vertebral column, and we call those the prevertebral or collateral ganglia. But in every case, there's going to be at least, what, a preganglionic and postganglionic fiber, with only one exception. Okay, the sympathetic division is characterized by what we call mass activation. The sympathetic nervous system really just can't affect the heart without affecting the digestive tract and without affecting your respiratory tract and your eyes. It affects everything in your body pretty much at all times because of the amount of divergence and convergence within these different neural pathways. So for instance, if we go back, how do we go back? No, don't end show, don't end show. Yeah, I need to hit preview. Let's see. Do I have? Oh, here I can use an arrow right here. Nice. On the keyboard. All right, so let's follow the outflow pathway from this one neuron. What do we mean by divergence? We follow it right through. Ah, the white ramus communicantes. That's nice because it's a myelinated fiber. Look at this junction right here. There's a lot of bifurcation in this neuron. So this action potential will go where? It will end in this ganglion, but it will also go up a division or two. It's also going to pass through. It's going to go down a division or two. And so this one action potential and this one motor fiber is going to travel where? In many locations in the body because this nerve bifurcates. So sympathetic activation happens all over the body because of the nature of the bifurcations of these neurons. Okay? And also, right, maybe if this nerve right here is damaged, this postganglionic neuron is still going to be stimulated because of collaterals that converge on this postganglionic fiber. All right, so convergence is also an important indication. What's wrong in your textbook is that this white ramus communicantes is really what, the second one over here. This one is really the gray one if you really want to be precise about that. All right, so the dotted line represents what kind of nerve fiber, myelinated or non-myelinated? It's non-myelinated, so the postganglionics are non-myelinated. Okay, here I can see the paravertebral ganglia, or the sympathetic chain ganglia, and then, for instance, if there is no synapse for the preganglionic fiber in the sympathetic chain, it passes through via splanchnic nerve into this prevertebral ganglia, and then here is going to be, for sure, a synapse, right? And then the postganglionic neuron leaves to go to the effector organ from that location. With one exception, and that is innervation of the adrenal medulla, but it's just a minor modification. Let me see what the next slide looks like. Next slide, no. Okay, let me go back to this one right here. Okay, here is, can you picture the adrenal gland? And I see some nerves going to it. Where is the adrenal medulla at? That's the deep part, right? The medulla is the deep part of any organ. So sympathetic nerves, a preganglionic nerve, will pass right through the sympathetic chain, pass through any collateral ganglia, and synapse on cells within the adrenal medulla. The adrenal medulla is acting like the ganglion in a typical sympathetic outflow pathway. There are special cells that are modified neurons, and when they become stimulated from this nerve right here, which is the preganglionic, they automatically release epinephrine and norepinephrine. All right, so these cells are like the quasi postganglionic cells, but they don't send action potentials anywhere. They don't have axons, but when they depolarize, they automatically release epinephrine and norepinephrine. Okay, so mostly epinephrine and norepinephrine, and then this epinephrine and norepinephrine is picked up by capillaries in the adrenal medulla, and then where does epinephrine and norepinephrine go from there, from the adrenal medulla? They go into the bloodstream, and then where does it go? Everywhere in the body, everywhere that blood goes. So this huge sympathetic signal, namely epinephrine and norepinephrine, travels everywhere in the body. Again, that's kind of the hallmark of the sympathetic nervous system, which is what? Mass activation. Anything that has a adrenergic receptor or a receptor for epinephrine or norepinephrine becomes a target tissue. Your heart, your eyes, your respiratory tract, digestive tract, all becomes under the influence of the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so that's the only sympathetic outflow pathway that has a single neuron, because the cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic neuron. All right, so epinephrine, all right, starts by being made from tyrosine. Okay, can anybody tell me what tyrosine is? It's amino acid, okay, so you can see the alpha carbon and the carboxyl group and the amino group and all that kind of stuff. But it's a special kind of amino acid. What kind of special amino acid is it? It is an essential. This is an amino acid because of this aromatic ring right here. It cannot be synthesized in our body, so that means you have to have it in your diet. And you get this typically very easily from animal proteins. It's more difficult from plant sources. But so if you don't have the proper diet, then you can't make epinephrine and norepinephrine by this pathway. So tyrosine, right, is changed into DOPA, then dopamine, and then norepinephrine, and then finally into epinephrine. And that can happen in the adrenal medulla, and the adrenal medulla then stores epinephrine and norepinephrine until it receives sympathetic signals to be released. Okay, parasympathetic division. Sometimes we call that cranial sacral outflow because parasympathetic stimulation leaves only from cranial nerves, and most notably, you should know at least one. Which cranial nerve is most responsible for parasympathetic outflow? The vagus nerve. And how many cranial nerves are there? There are 12. Okay, there's maybe a little discussion on that, but there are 12 generally accepted cranial nerves, and the vagus nerve is indeed which number? Number 10. Okay, just number is X, the letter X, number 10. Okay, and the vagus nerve kind of bifurcates, goes all over the place. There are ganglia as well, because even parasympathetic outflow requires two neurons, a preganglionic and postganglionic neuron, but the ganglia for parasympathetic outflow is right next to the target organ, like the heart, or even inside the organ itself. And so the postganglionic fiber is very short for the parasympathetic nervous system. Right, so the postganglionics have very short axons that directly innervate the target organs. So, for instance, here we see that vagus nerve, okay, number 10, and it innervates the heart, and it innervates the superior abdominal cavity, and there it kind of stops. Innervation of the pelvic cavity comes from sacral nerves, right, from S2 through S4. Okay, and the effects are going to be antagonistic to the sympathetic nervous system. So here is a nice chart that kind of illustrates everything very nicely. You can see craniosacral outflow, so that looks like blue to me. That represents what? Parasympathetic outflow, both cranial and sacrally. And the solid lines represent nice preganglionic fibers, right, which are myelinated. And then here is the ganglion. The dotted lines represents postganglionic fibers that are non-myelinated. And each of these are chemical synapses within the ganglion and also at the effector organ as well. And then you can track and trace even the sympathetic outflow, which is what, thoracolumbar. And you see that all these nerves enter the sympathetic chain. Some pass directly through, like we see some solid colored lines passing right through to a prevertebral ganglia someplace located in front of the spinal cord. And then you have the postganglionic fibers. And again, these are chemical synapses right here, so we're going to learn what the neurotransmitters are that's being used for these two systems. And the postganglionic sympathetic fibers are relatively long, as we see right here. But for these blue ones, notice how short they are. Postganglionics for parasympathetic are very short. The only thing that kind of stands out as being different is what? The innervation of the adrenal medulla. Let's trace that. So we said solid color. What are solid colored nerves, whether they're red or blue? Solid colors are the preganglionic fibers. So here's a preganglionic fiber passing right through the sympathetic chain. Oh, look, it's even passing through this prevertebral ganglion, right? Because it still hasn't synapsed. And where is this one noteworthy fiber going to go? All the way to the adrenal medulla. And inside the adrenal medulla are the chromaffin cells that are acting like the postganglionic fibers. And when they become stimulated by the neurotransmitter from the preganglionic fiber, what do? Do they send action potential someplace? When they depolarize, they just immediately release epinephrine and norepinephrine, which then travels all over the body. So this is a pretty good example of the autonomic nervous system, the anatomy of it. The only other thing that I want to point out to you, there are a number of nerves that sympathetic nerves that pass right through the sympathetic chain, going to some prevertebral ganglion someplace. And in each case, these nerves that are myelinated going to the prevertebral ganglia are going to be called a splanchnic nerve. So be aware of the name splanchnic nerve, pass right through the sympathetic chain. But I don't want you to know a greater from lesser or inferior splanchnic. Just know that those are splanchnic nerves and that they're preganglionics. All right, so here is a table that shows the effector organ. And so these are either going to be glands or cardiac muscle or smooth muscle, and what the effect of sympathetic or parasympathetic stimulation is. Okay, and in most cases, you're going to see that it's antagonistic, like the ciliary muscle, all right, for the accommodation reflex. Sympathetic is for far vision, and parasympathetic causes the opposite, causes contraction for near vision. Let's look at something that's a little bit noteworthy here. Let's look at the heart. Sympathetic tone, increasing sympathetic activity, or what we call sympathetic tone, has the effect of increasing heart rate. You see rate over on the left-hand side. But what about parasympathetic tone? Decreases heart rate. And the rate of conduction of action potentials over the heart increases with sympathetic activity, decreases with parasympathetic activity. All right, but now let's look at this one. This is interesting. What about force of contraction? Force of contraction under increasing sympathetic tone, what, increases or decreases? As we increase sympathetic activity, what happens to the strength of contraction of the heart? It increases. And maybe you were in a car accident or almost in a car accident, you thought you were going to die, get run over by a big truck out on the 405 freeway, and you happen to swerve at the last moment and you survive, and you notice an increase in heart rate. But what else do you notice about your heart? If you're for sure you were going to die, what else is your heart doing? It's beating. It's like jumping out of your chest, right? So it's not just the heart rate, but the force of contraction is exaggerated as well. It goes way up. All right, so we talk about those two effects differently because indeed they are different. Okay, when we talk about effects that adjust heart rate, nice marker right here. All right, we call this chronotropy. Okay, anything, an agent that has a chronotropic effect on the heart is going to adjust the what of the heart?
Rate.
The heart rate. All right, so I'm going to put heart rate right here. And then we're also going to put heart contractility. Right, and heart contractility has got a different name. It's called inotropy. Okay, so let's analyze these terms and use these terms just a little bit so we become familiar with them. All right, so let's think of sympathetic stimulation on the heart. And where's my little marker? Here's my little marker right here, and it's in the sympathetic column. So what kind of agent is a sympathetic effect, like epinephrine or norepinephrine? What's it going to do to heart rate? It's going to increase, right? So we call that a positive chronotropic effect because it increases heart rate. And what about parasympathetic stimulation, a parasympathetic effect on the heart? What's going to happen to heart rate? It will decrease, and so it's going to be raised, so it's going to be chronotropy. Is it going to be a positive or a negative? Yeah, so it's a negative chronotropic agent, right, because it will decrease heart rate. What about strength of contraction? Where is strength of contraction? We got to go down two rows. All right, what is the effect of sympathetic stimulation? And is it going to affect chronotropy or inotropy?
Inotropy,
and it increases the strength of contraction, so it's what, a positive inotropic agent. What about parasympathetic activity on the heart? Let's look. Look what it says right here. In terms of strength of contraction, does it have any effect at all? It has no effect. So it is not, it's neither a positive nor a negative inotropic agent on the heart. So that's kind of strange. Sympathetic affects both inotropy and chronotropy, but parasympathetic stimulation only affects the rate or chronotropy of the heart. So that's one interesting thing. Now let's look at some blood vessels. Okay. Blood vessels under sympathetic tone will cause constriction, and that will raise blood pressure. And just like on the heart, right, parasympathetic stimulation has very little effect. Only in a few organs will it affect blood flow. In particular, the penis would be an example. But in most other organs of the body, parasympathetic stimulation has no effect on blood flow. So what kind of control are we missing right here? We have one nervous system that causes constriction. Let's just analyze that for a second. Say you have a balloon, and you squeeze down on that balloon, what happens to the pressure inside the balloon? Does it change? Do you think it changes, or does it stay the same if you squeeze the balloon down? Okay. I hear some people say change. I like that. But how's it going to change? How's the pressure going to change? Is it going to increase or decrease when you squeeze down on it? Yeah, I would say increase, because if you squeeze it really hard, what's going to happen to that balloon? It's going to pop because the pressure inside the balloon went way, way up, right? All right, so when you vasoconstrict, that is a way of increasing blood pressure. One way of thinking about it is just by squeezing down on a balloon. But other things happen, too, that we're going to talk about. All right, so what do we call that process if your blood pressure is way too high? That's the name of a disease process. Hypertension. And what do you know about hypertension? Is it a prevalent disease process in our population, or only a few people, only a handful of people have it? A lot of people have it. Probably we all had it last week when you had the test, okay? But hopefully that went away. But hypertension is a serious disease, okay? And let's look at our human body in its engineering. What is a good way to make sure that you have precise control and balance over some important function of your body? Antagonistic control. Now, does your body have antagonistic control over vasoconstriction and vasodilation of blood vessels? You know what? In most places in your body, you do not. Except for the penis, you do. But in other parts of the body, you do not. Your autonomic nervous system only causes vasoconstriction, which increases blood pressure. Parasympathetic nervous system really is ineffective in lowering blood pressure. So it really doesn't surprise me that hypertension is a serious problem in our population, because our bodies just aren't designed with that nice antagonistic principle, which is kind of a shame. Okay, bronchioles. Okay, sympathetic. Bronchioles. That's your airways dilate under sympathetic stimulation. And does that support the flight and flight mechanism model in your mind for sympathetic nervous system? Okay, yes or no for dilating airways. As your airways dilate, it's easier to ventilate lungs. It's easier to move air in and out of your lungs. So it's easier to have nice oxygenated blood perfuse your heart and brain and muscles and things like that. So it fits in that model very nicely. Parasympathetic causes constriction. All right, so I don't want to spend a whole lot of time, but you should notice that the effects are what going to be generally antagonistic to each other, but in some circumstances, you see that one system is not innervated while the other one is. Okay. But that's just a nice general principle that you should be aware of. All right, now here is something which is kind of the crux of this chapter, which is a little bit more molecular, but this is really the meat and potatoes of this chapter, because this is how we handle disease processes by giving drugs to people that affect different kinds of receptors, mimic neurotransmitters, enhance their effect or decrease their effect inside the body. All right, so on the right-hand side, you can see the nice central nervous system with various outflow pathways. And again, I see two different colors. What are the two different colors that you see? I see blue and green right there, red. Okay, blue and red. And those represent what? The two divisions of the autonomic nervous system. And clearly the blue is cranial sacral or parasympathetic. And the red right here clearly is thoracolumbar or what? Sympathetic outflow. And in every case, right, you see a ganglion. So there's a preganglionic, postganglionic fiber, with the exception of what organ? The adrenal medulla. So this is really not a ganglion. This is really the adrenal medulla. And when it becomes stimulated by sympathetic action potentials, it directly releases what? Epinephrine and norepinephrine. And these get picked up by the blood. So how is norepinephrine and epinephrine working in this particular case? If these are chemical messengers that are picked up by the blood and delivered by the cardiovascular system, what would you call that kind of chemical messenger? Would you call that a neurotransmitter or a hormone? That would be a good example of a hormone, right? So in this circumstance, norepinephrine and norepinephrine are functioning as hormones. Okay. Well, let's look at each of these different ganglia right here. Both the parasympathetic and sympathetic ganglia use acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter. All right, so all of these solid lines right here, what, regardless if they're blue or red, are what we call what kind of fibers? Cholinergic or adrenergic? They're cholinergic fibers because they all release acetylcholine. Okay, in the ganglion right here. And even within the adrenal medulla, this preganglionic fiber releases acetylcholine, and it is excitatory. It causes depolarization. Right? So that's going to cause an action potential to go down this postganglionic fiber, and when that action potential reaches the axon terminus for this blue outflow pathway. What's blue again? What's blue? Parasympathetic, right? Acetylcholine is released once again. So for the parasympathetic autonomic system, both the preganglionic and postganglionic fibers are what kind of fibers? They are what we call cholinergic because they release acetylcholine. So they have to have acetylcholine receptors in these dendrites of the ganglia, but also these effector organs right here. Okay, now let's look at the sympathetic nervous system. What's the neurotransmitter of the preganglionic fiber? It is also acetylcholine in every single case. But what about the neurotransmitter for the postganglionic fibers? It is norepinephrine. So here's a big change. Norepinephrine is really the neurotransmitter of the sympathetic nervous system. Acetylcholine is for the parasympathetic nervous system. And you can find exceptions to this rule in various parts of your body, but we're not going to get into that. If a nerve releases norepinephrine at the axon terminus when an action potential arrives there, we call that an adrenergic synapse, and that neuron is what? Adrenergic, because it's secreting norepinephrine. What kind of neurotransmitter is secreted if it's a cholinergic neuron? Acetylcholine, right? So we use those terms interchangeably just like that. Okay, so some sympathetic neurons can release acetylcholine, so don't be shocked if you run into that sometime in your career. Okay, so how do these things work? All right, so here we have an example of an effector organ, namely smooth muscle. Okay, and let's just think of a somatic skeletal muscle. And we haven't talked about it yet, but maybe from anatomy you can remember something about the neuromuscular junction. Does anybody remember the neurotransmitter that's used at the neuromuscular junction for skeletal muscle? It is acetylcholine, okay? And at the receptors in skeletal muscle are just of the nicotinic type, so that when acetylcholine binds receptor on skeletal muscle, it opens up a sodium channel, and it's a huge sodium channel. So a lot of sodium rushes inside a skeletal muscle cell. What does that do? That depolarizes the skeletal muscle, right, which is what? Inhibitory or excitatory? It's excitatory, and the neuromuscular junction is huge. It's a huge excitatory signal, which always sets up action potentials over the skeletal muscle cell, causing the whole muscle cell to depolarize, which does what? It excites the whole muscle cell into contraction. So if there is an action potential coming down a somatic motor neuron, it always causes that skeletal muscle to contract. The skeletal muscle can never make up its own mind and say, no, I don't want to contract, right? You want to have a glass of water? Those skeletal muscles just obey your commands, which is different than, for instance, smooth muscle. And let's see why that might be. So here we see a smooth muscle. And what kind of innervation does it have? It has both sympathetic and parasympathetic innervation. We call that dual innervation. All right? And neurotransmitter is not released just from the axon terminus of these motor neurons, these autonomic motor neurons, but it's released from what we call varicosities, right? And these varicosities are kind of like little strings of pearls. They're periodically arranged along an axon, and as an action potential flows over this varicosity, guess what it does? It's a sympathetic neuron. It's going to release norepinephrine. Okay, and then when an action potential flows over this varicosity right here, this is like a Bouton terminale, but it's in the middle of an axon someplace, it's going to release norepinephrine. And then when it flows over here, it's going to release norepinephrine, right? So norepinephrine is going to be released from this whole string of pearls. But what else can happen? Maybe an action potential is coming down this parasympathetic neuron right here, and it has varicosities as well. And what is the neurotransmitter? Sorry about that wandering cursor. And as an action potential flows over that varicosity right there, what neurotransmitter is being released? Acetylcholine, right? So now you have a mixture of signals. That can one can cause excitation, the other can cause inhibition, And depending on the balance of those signals, this smooth muscle can decide whether it's going to contract or not. So that's a difference compared to skeletal muscle. All right, so let's zoom down into, so we call these varicosities, right, synapses and passant, meaning as this axon passes through this tissue, it has a way of releasing a lot of neurotransmitter in a lot of different places because these smooth muscles have receptors over a broad region on their cell membrane, not just underneath the motor end plate, for instance, of a skeletal muscle. Now, what kind of receptors do these look like? Can you kind of picture this right here? I see that, okay, here's a receptor, and it's coupled to a G protein. I don't see the G protein, but this is typically what they look like in diagrammatic form. All right, so these are adrenergic receptors that will bind norepinephrine, and then these are cholinergic receptors that will bind acetylcholine. But remember, the G protein coupled receptors are not nicotinic. They are of what kind? Muscarinic. These are muscarinic receptors, so they act through different kinds of mechanisms. But nonetheless, they're cholinergic receptors. Okay. So now this membrane will be under the influence of maybe excitation and inhibition at the same time. Okay, so here's something that's pretty interesting, but a little complicated, but all important. This is really important, and you should, if there's one thing that you should take from this class on to some kind of clinical practice when you start doing rounds in hospitals and things like that, is to appreciate that, yeah, that one neurotransmitter, okay, and we're going to say adrenergic stimulation. So what kind of neurotransmitter are we talking about if it's adrenergic? It's going to be norepinephrine, okay? Norepinephrine, even though it's a single neurotransmitter, it can have opposite effects in the body depending on what part of the body it is. Sometimes it can be excitatory, sometimes it can be inhibitory. And why is it that one neurotransmitter can have opposite effects? Because before a tissue can be a target tissue, what does it have to have? It's got to have a receptor. Okay? And it just so happens that there are many different kinds of adrenergic receptors. So norepinephrine, depending on what kind of receptor it binds to, will produce a different effect. All right? So there are two main classes of receptors. There are called alpha receptors and beta receptors. These are adrenergic. All right? So that's all we're going to be talking about right now is sympathetic stimulation. And there are even some subclasses of alpha and beta receptors. And in this class, we're going to talk about the alpha ones, okay, maybe not the alpha twos, and we'll talk about beta ones and beta twos in this class. And then there's even subclasses beyond that. But for this class, this is what we're going to be interested in. All right, so in every case, both the alpha and beta receptors are G protein coupled, working through second messenger. So norepinephrine, what about norepinephrine? Does it ever enter the cell? No. It's just going to change some kind of metabolism somehow to produce a second messenger inside the cell, which then carries the message and it changes the physiology, right? So all adrenergic receptors are G protein, unlike nicotinic receptors, which are what? Just a direct ion channel, right? Beta receptors use cyclic AMP as a second messenger, while the alpha use calcium as a second messenger. So under alpha adrenergic stimulation, calcium levels increase inside the cell. Under beta adrenergic stimulation, cyclic AMP increases inside cells, which then changes the activity of cells. So here's a pretty handy table that you should skim over. And there, we also have a really good graphic to look at. Okay, contraction of the radial fibers of the iris, which actually dilates the pupil. So let's just say sympathetic stimulation on the pupil causes dilation, right? That's an alpha 1. So, and it's contraction. So alpha 1 is what? Typically excitatory or inhibitory? If it causes contraction of smooth muscles, it's excitatory. Right? Even though it causes dilation, it just has to, when we get the senses, you see why contraction of a muscle actually causes pupil dilation. That's an alpha 1 receptor. So think of alpha 1 as being excitatory. Let's look at some other alpha ones right here. Skin and blood vessels, right? It causes constriction. That's going to decrease blood flow. That's an alpha one. All right, skeletal muscles. Again, it causes constriction. So these are what? Excitatory. So think of alpha ones are always excitatory. And in the lungs, we don't have alpha. We have a different kind. Yeah, we got beta receptors. So let's look at the heart and the lungs. Okay, the heart does not have alpha receptors. It has beta receptors. And maybe you could have guessed at that because maybe you have some family members that need to help regulate their heart rate or blood pressure by decreasing heart rate. And sometimes what kind of agent is prescribed for them? Okay, beta blocker, so they're referring to this particular class of receptors. It's a beta what kind of receptor? Beta adrenergic receptor in the heart. Okay, and what does, when the beta 1 receptor in the heart is stimulated, what happens? Increased heart rate, increased force of contraction. So beta 1 receptors are positive chronotropic and inotropic effectors on the heart. It increases both heart rate and heart strength, which then is going to increase your blood pressure. So if you use a beta blocker, what happens to blood pressure? It's going to be a negative inotropic effect that's going to decrease heart rate and force of contraction. That's going to help lower somebody's blood pressure if they use a beta blocker. Okay, and a lot of drugs like to be very specific. We would like to be able to target beta receptors or beta 1 without affecting alpha receptors or beta 2 receptors. It's not right at that point yet, but drugs are being developed so that that can happen. All right, there's another kind of beta receptor, and those are the beta 2. Okay, and let's look at beta 2s in certain blood vessels, arterioles. Right, when they become stimulated, what does it produce? Causes a dilation. Dilation is a result of inhibition, right? So it's inhibiting these smooth muscles. So they start to dilate. Beta 2 also in airways, like bronchioles, when they become stimulated, okay, what happens to bronchioles? The smooth muscles relax, they dilate, it's easier to breathe in and out of our bodies as a result. So when people are taking inhalants because they're having an asthma attack or maybe even emphysema, but primarily asthma attack, right? One way to dilate bronchioles that are becoming constricted is to use an adrenergic effector that binds to these beta 2 receptors, which causes dilation of bronchioles. All right, so what's a good way to think of these things right here? Okay. We got a slide on these alpha 1s and beta 2s down here for the liver in just a second we're going to talk about. But how are you going to realize or remember the difference between beta 1 and beta 2? And it seems really complicated and just brute force memorization, but there's a really easy trick. How many hearts do you have? You have one. And what kind of beta receptor is in your one heart? Beta 1 receptors. Okay, so just memorize that and that will get you going in the right direction. How many lungs do you have? Yeah, you got a right and a left, you know, the major lobes. What kind of receptors do you have in your lungs? Beta 2. Okay, so just think of that little trick. Okay. All right, so this is a table that you should probably spend some time at and look at. Sorry, we're out of time. So here is an exam figure, which we're going to start with next time, and then we just have a couple slides left in this chapter. But go ahead. Oh, today I missed it. This would have been a good extra credit quiz. Sorry about that. But memorize this figure right here. This is a good figure for you to memorize because it goes over the different receptor types. All right, so who's got that sign-in sheet? And it's coming down to the front. So please sign the sign-in sheet. Thanks for your patience today. I had to take over for another instructor's lab. And it was lab work that required many weeks. So they couldn't just not do 1 week's work because then the experiment would break in the middle.